Okay, we're going to begin today. Before the lecture, we have an announcement about the CAP program in Washington, which is a terrific program that some of you may be interested in taking part in. The person who's going to tell us about it, her name is Grace, and you were a participant in the program when last year?
Yeah, I was.
Okay,
last year.
So go to it.
Okay, yeah, so I'm Grace. I did the CAP program last year, last winter quarter, and I'm actually the outreach coordinator for the program. So if you have any questions, actually put my email address at the bottom too, so if you want to email me or stop by the office if you have any questions, Carol's always there. But just a little bit about the program. You earn 12 or up to 16 units in political science, history, or sociology, and they're all upper division units. So it's a really great way to get easy UCLA transferable upper division units. You get to do an internship. That's part of your four units. And you also do a really big research paper. That's your like big school work while you're there, which is really good if you want to go to grad school, law school, any sort of field after undergrad. Really great way to tailor that kind of research specific focus. I did mine on environmental law while I was there, and I worked at the Environmental Protection Agency, so really great way to get that focus. And we help you get those internships while you're there, so don't worry about that. We have a really specific database of all the past internships that past CAPers have done, and like really try to help you get that, you know, that internship down. Financial aid applies, so you don't have to worry about that. And you live in the UCDC Center, which is about four blocks away from the White House, so that's really great. And you take your classes in the UCDC Center. Electives, you can take electives while you're there. I took an elective with a writer from the Washington Post on environmental policy. You take criminology, special capital specific ones. They're really tailored specific to great Washington programs while you're there. So the application for fall 2014, the deadline is February 28th, but the CAP program is year round. So if you want to do it any quarter, you can stop by the office at any time to talk about that. Or if you're just thinking ahead and just want to keep the CAP program in mind, just can check out the website, check out the past internships. That's all on a database on the website too. So when I just came to UCLA, I always knew I wanted to do the program. Excuse me. So I just always checked it out and then figured out, kind of planned it out when the right time for going to Washington would be. So you can stop by, just always check it out, keep it in the back of your mind. We have a Facebook, we have an Instagram that I manage, so don't be freaked out by that. It's not someone else doing it, it's just me. So the back of the flyer is a little bit outdated. It's talking about spring, so we'll get a new one out there soon. So check it out, and again, don't be a stranger in the office. Carol really likes it when you stop by and talk about potential research topics for your paper. So that's about it.
Okay,
so
that's great.
Don't hesitate to be a stranger. It's a really great program. I like did it, and now I work in the office, so I fully support it. So.
It's terrific. We've had really great feedback from students who've done it. So thanks,
yeah,
thanks very much.
Okay, great.
Today I'm going to be talking about the July crisis, the crisis that broke out on June 28, 1914, with the assassination of the heir to the Austrian throne, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo by Serbian nationalists, people who had a certain degree of support from the Serbian state, and especially from the Serbian secret services. That wasn't fully known at that time. A crisis. Yes, you need me to talk louder? Blow what up? That thing? No, that's a. I think. Well, let's see. If someone knows how to do that. Bottom right, okay. Oh, yeah, okay. The plus, okay. The real bottom right, okay. All right, is that better? All right, so. All right. Okay. This crisis which broke out at the end of June and lasted through the entire month of July, leading to the outbreak of actual hostilities at the beginning of August 1914. It's what we call the July Crisis. This is basically a clash between Austria, that was determined to do what it could to prevent the Serbs from conducting terrorist activities aimed at the destruction of the Austrian state, a policy that was backed by Austria's one real ally, Germany, a conflict between the Central Powers on the one hand, Serbia, backed by Russia, with Russia supported by France in very much the same way that Germany supported Austria, and ultimately Britain came in on the side of France and Russia after a certain degree of hesitation. But this great conflict between two blocks of powers of approximately equal military strength led to an enormous bloodletting that lasted for 4 years and only ended with the American intervention in the First World War after 1917. Even then, it took over a year for Germany to be defeated. Okay. In the lecture today, we're not going to be giving a blow-by-blow description of all the different things that happened during the crisis. This is an enormously involved and complex crisis with all kinds of things going on. Instead, we're going to be concerned with a theoretical problem, a conceptual problem. And we're using this crisis as a vehicle for getting at that conceptual problem. This is this great issue that we're concerned with in this class of, you know, what makes for war? How can you understand war? And, you know, there's a certain theory of what makes for war. It's like, well, it's the fall of the system. People don't choose war. No one wants war. You know, but statesmen are overwhelmed by these forces welling up. You know, like from within the military system. There's an enormous emphasis placed on systemic factors rather than intent. You know, instead of looking at the outbreak of a conflict as the result of deliberate policies, the tendency is to view people as being overwhelmed by forces that they couldn't control, swept away. Okay? And it's a very important theory in general. And one particular form of that theory, which is the theory that placed enormous emphasis on military factors as opposed to political as the driving force behind war, played a very important role during the Cold War period. It's the conceptual basis of arms control. Why should you worry about arms control? Why is arms control considered so important? Well, it's considered important because people have a certain theory of what makes for war. Military factors play a fundamental role in bringing on a war that would otherwise be avoided. Therefore, if you want to avoid a war, you should, you know, pay a lot of attention to what sort of military structure is in place. Right? And you can do this to a considerable extent through arms control agreements, reducing the incentive to go first. Right? Both sides have the kind of weapons that are useful only in support of defensive policies. Neither side is attempted to preempt in a crisis, to go first in a crisis. Well, that would make for a more stable world. So that's why we should aim it. And so the people say, well, why is this stuff considered so important? Why is it not the case that political considerations are the driving force rather than military? So, oh, well, it happened once before. Look at how it happened in 1914. Look at how military factors played a fundamental role in bringing on a war in 1914, a war that would otherwise have been avoided. These are very common notions in the literature, in the scholarly literature, especially in political science. And as I say, they played a rather important role in shaping policy during the Cold War period, especially the enormous emphasis somewhat on arms control and what goes on in the military sphere. Okay. given its importance, both in theoretical terms and in practical political terms, you really have to ask yourself, how can you go about getting at the question of how valid it is? How do you make up your mind about what to make of this theory? Right? And there's this method, right? This is, again, it's almost as though the method is more important than the substantive issue. The whole basic idea is you look at what people say about this stuff and how they support their general arguments with more specific claims, and how those more specific claims are supported by hard empirical evidence, right? You look at the structure of arguments in that sense, and then you analyze those things. Do those claims, even if valid, support these general points? Are those specific claims valid? Is the evidence that's cited to support these claims sufficient to really support them, and so on? In other words, you don't approach this problem directly, you approach it indirectly. You want to let these guys who make this the sort of argument do your work for you. You know, the burden is on them. They're the ones who are making this case. They're the ones who want to convince you that the military system is of such fundamental importance in bringing on a war. Well, how do they do it? Well, they make specific arguments. Well, let's examine those arguments. How good are they? What sort of evidence do these people themselves use to make their claims? All right. So I tried to kind of get at this. I don't know if those of you in the back can see this. And certainly the people who are just listening to this on Broomcast can't see it, but it's schematically, this is the kind of thing you want to do. You always want to go from the abstract to the particular. For the most general thing, these systemic theories, what makes for war? In this case, military factors play a fundamental role. The military system brought on a war, can bring on a war that would never have happened except for the kind of system, the military system that's in place. What's the support for that? A general historical interpretation. That's how war came in July 1914, right? That general historical interpretation is then supported by specific claims, specific arguments. In what way did the military system bring on a war in 1914? Oh, it was because the war plans were so rigid. It was because of the emphasis that these militaries at the time placed on rapid offensive action. These military plans were not defensive in nature, they were offensive in nature. And most important, the whole notion was that it was the mobilization system that was in place at the time. The way one mobilization would trigger other mobilizations, and this would bring on a war. It's kind of like a spontaneous combustion sort of thing. I should say just in passing, what does mobilization mean? It means, in this context of 1914, the calling up of reserves and their deployment to forces in the field. Right. The military system they had in 1914 was not one of very large standing armies. The standing armies were only about maybe a tenth of the size of that the armies would have once the reservists were called up and deployed to their units. Right. So just drawing on the great mass of people who had been trained in the military for a couple of years and then sent back to civilian life as reservists, and they would get additional training every summer and so on. That's what mobilization means. Okay? And the claim in the literature is that it was this mobilization system, these interacting mobilizations, that led to this war. All right? And then those specific claims then are supported in the literature by empirical evidence. In support of this argument about the rigidity of war plans, they tell this story about what happened on August 1st, 1914, when the Germans got word that the British might stay out of the war if the Germans changed their plan and didn't fight the war in the West and fought the war only in the East and you know, kind of did not invade France or Belgium. The story is the Kaiser was jubilant when he heard about this British offer. He turned to the military and he said, "Okay, we'll accept the offer. So let's now change our plans and stay on the defensive in the West and fight the war in the East." And then the military said to him, "Your Majesty, it cannot be done. We're locked into this one and only one plan. And then they said, the Kaiser had no answer for this and gave way. And this is an example of how these rigid war plans could bring on a war that no one wanted, supposedly. Right? So that's an example of a piece of empirical evidence supporting a claim about a particular claim, the rigidity of war plans claim about how a war could come because of these military factors, a war that didn't make any sense in political terms, a war that the political leadership would never have sanctioned if they weren't kind of stampeded into it by these military considerations. Okay? That's the structure of the argument. And what that means is that once you grasp the structure of the argument, you're then in a position to examine it systematically. Right? You know, we begin with this whole business about rigid war plans causing the war. Is it valid? Well, let's look at this, you know, look at it and see whether it makes sense, both in terms of the empirical evidence that's supporting it. You know, is this a cat that you find in the literature about what happened on August 1st accurate? And second, the logic of it, you know, does it really make sense to say that the fact that the war plans were rigid was a cause of the war? I mean, what if the war plans had been less rigid, more flexible? Would war then have been avoided if these countries had had more options for themselves? That's an example of a point about logic. You always apply those two tests. So that's what we're going to be doing today. That's the structure of the problem, and therefore that's going to be the structure of the lecture. First, we're going to be looking at these arguments about the rigidity of war plans, then arguments about the cult of the offensive, and third, arguments about interactive mobilizations. Okay. There's a famous book by a popular historian named Barbara Tuchman called The Guns of August about the coming of the First World War, or the initial phase of the First World War. Came out in 1962. Very popular. President Kennedy and a lot of his advisors, they had read this book when it came out. It was very much in their minds when the Cuban Missile Crisis broke out in October of 1962. Kennedy, you know, and his advisors said, well, we don't want people to talk about the missiles of October the same way that Barbara Tuchman talked about the guns of August. And Barbara Tuchman embraced this whole argument about it's the war plans that were responsible. You know, the statesmen didn't want a war. It can't be understood as the product of political decision. It's the military that was to blame. The sort of a structure that had taken place within the military sphere that had created these forces that welled up during the crisis and led to a war that no one wanted. I'll just read to you one of the key passages from the Tuchman book so you get a sense for the flavor of this argument. And this is a key passage. This is the final paragraph in her two-page introduction to the whole part of the book that dealt with the outbreak of the war. Final paragraph there. She says, war pressed against every frontier. Suddenly dismayed, governments struggled and twisted to fend it off. It was no use. Agents at frontiers were reporting every cavalry patrol as a deployment to beat the mobilization gun. General staffs, goaded by their relentless timetables, were pounding the table for the signal to move, lest their opponents gain an hour's head start. Appalled upon the brink, the chiefs of state, who would be ultimately responsible for their country's fate, attempted to back away, but the pull of military schedules dragged them forward. Okay, as I say, two tests. Test of evidence. What's the evidence that's given to support this? Well, as I say, the key piece of evidence that you find in the literature, in the writings of those who make this sort of argument about how it was the rigid nature of the war plans that brought on the war, was this story of what happened on August 1st, 1914. The Kaiser, as I said before, hears that the British are offering to stay out of the war if the Germans change their war plan and fight the war in the East and not in the West. The Germans have a war plan here. This is something everyone should know. It's called the Schlieffen Plan, right? That's how it's spelled. Schlieffen was the head of the German General Staff, General von Schlieffen. Not in 1914, he was succeeded by another general, General von Moltke, but in the first decade of the 20th century. And he had worked out a plan for a two-front war against both France and Russia. Russia mobilizes slowly. Russia is a backward country. Russia doesn't have the infrastructure to generate her military force, calling up the reserves and so on, bringing units to the frontier and so on, all that quickly. Right. So given that Russia mobilizes slowly, Germany has a certain window of opportunity. She doesn't have to worry too much about her eastern border during this period when Russia is still mobilizing. Her eastern border can be lightly defended. Therefore, she could concentrate the great bulk of her forces in the west, throw them against France, not directly, because the French side of the Franco-German frontier is very heavily fortified, but rather indirectly by marching through Belgium, having a climactic battle with France, knocking France out at the very beginning of the war, and then being able to pivot around and deal with Russia. Right? Why do the Germans want this sort of war? Because here's Germany, a powerful country, but packed into the heart of Europe, facing these three absolutely enormous empires with command of the seas and access to all the resources of North America as well. The British Empire, the Russian Empire, the French Empire. Right? If those countries have time to generate all the resources that they're capable of, to draw on these enormous resources that they have by virtue of their imperial and naval position, then Germany will be defeated in the end. Germany's only hope is for a rapid decision. This is not a touchstone of aggressiveness. You see this sort of logic at play over and over again in international political life. You want to understand why Israeli policy is aggressive at times? The answer is Israel knows that she can't fight a long war of attrition against the Arabs. She needs to mobilize quickly and reach a very rapid decision. Right? Similarly, Russia during the Cold War, why did the Russians invest so heavily in maintaining a capability for overrunning Western Europe, for having military superiority in Central Europe during the Cold War? It's because Russia knows that she doesn't have the resources to deal with a coalition of much richer and more technologically advanced powers, United States, Western Europe, and Japan, if those powers have the time to mobilize all their resources. So you got to act quickly. See, offensive military action can be rooted in defensive calculations of that sort. That's very much the case with Germany's Schlieffen Plan. To say the Germans had an offensive military doctrine, it's true, but it doesn't mean that there's something dark or aggressive, particularly aggressive about German policy as such. It's rooted in the structure of the situation. Important insight, by the way. Okay? The Germans have this Schlieffen plan. All their plans for how to fight a war were rooted in that basic strategic concept. Everything's worked out. All the mobilization schedules, the train schedules, and so on. They had built all these railroads so as to be able to transport their forces to the Belgian border and this sort of thing. Okay. And so there is this conflict between the Kaiser and his top military advisor, General von Moltke. When they receive this news from Britain, the British may well stay out of the war if the Germans stay on the defensive in the West and fight the war in the East, which means basically junking the Schlieffen plan and improvising something totally different. Right? And it's true that General von Moltke says to the Kaiser, "Your Majesty, it cannot be done. Basically, we have this one plan for fighting a war. We can't just improvise this sort of thing." But then what happens is very revealing. The Kaiser's reaction is, "Well, we're going to do it anyway." And he turns to his aide-de-camp and says, "Issue the orders. We're going to stop the move into France and Belgium and Luxembourg. You know, we're going to stay on the defensive in the West, and we will improvise a war in the East, because the political benefits of doing so, keeping Britain out of the war, are so enormous." Okay? And Moltke wrote a little memoir during the war. He says, "I thought my heart would break. I went home and cried tears of despair." Well, that's not the reaction of someone who had managed to get his way and had defeated the emperor. It's the reaction of someone who had been overruled. You see, this one story, which is the most important empirical support for this claim that it was the rigidity of war plans that brought on a war that no one wanted, it just doesn't stand up. Now, what about the test of logic? This is the second test. Suppose the war plans had been more flexible. In this case, suppose the Germans had more than one option, more than one plan in the drawer, that it would have been easy for them to choose between fighting the war in the East and fighting the war in the West. If the German military stance had been more flexible in that sense, why would war have been prevented? Say, either that alternate plan would be better than the Schlieffen plan, or it wouldn't. If it would be better than the Schlieffen plan, and that's what they would have done, that would have meant that the Schlieffen plan hamstrung German policy, that it weakened German policy, to put Germany in a weaker position. But if Germany was in a weaker position because she had a better, in theory, a better plan, but was locked into pursuing a relatively bad plan, and this weakened German policy, well, why should that have led to greater German toughness in any of these political debates? You think it would have led Germany to pursue a more accommodating policy if she was locked into a relatively weak military stance, right? On the other hand, if it didn't make any difference, or if the policy of fighting the war in the East was no better, or in fact worse than fighting it in the West, it wouldn't have made any difference that the Germans had this greater flexibility. So in either case, it's very hard to make the argument that it was the rigidity of war plans that brought on a war that would otherwise have been avoided. I mean, that's you get the flavor of this sort of analysis. The test of logic, the test of evidence, the breaking down of these core arguments into kind of specific claims, the sense that they were kind of general, almost theoretical, conceptual issues that are at play here. All right. Number two is this cult of the offensive business. Cult of the offensive. I should tell you a little bit about the intellectual background of this, because it relates to ideas that were developed in this very building that you're sitting in now. There's a famous international relations scholar, very good scholar, very interesting scholar, named Robert Jervis. And when he was an assistant professor, he taught in our department here. His office was right on the fourth floor of this building. And when he was there, he wrote this article, which is just one of a handful of truly important articles in international relations theory, called Cooperation Under the Security Dilemma. Right? He wrote it when he was an assistant professor here. And the basic Jervis argument is, it's along the lines of what I was saying before. It's like, people think you could distinguish sharply between aggressive and defensive behavior. It's not true. Sometimes countries are forced to behave like aggressors, for purely defensive purposes. The line between what's aggressive and what's defensive tends to be blurred, for, you know, the reasons I was suggesting before. And so there are these structural problems, systemic problems, that would prevent states from cooperating, right, to avoid war, if both sides are forced, no matter what their basic political goals were. You know, they may want to reach an accommodation, but they're forced to behave like aggressors because that's the only way of providing for their own security, right? This whole notion is called the security dilemma. He says, then he goes on and he says, but what are the factors that determine how serious the security dilemma is, how pernicious it is? He uses that word. And he says, basically, it's the kind of military system that you have. Whether it places emphasis on offensive or military stance. And a world that's offense dominant, where people opt for these offensive military strategies, the offensive military doctrines, you know, going on the attack, you know, dealing with the enemy really fast. It says this accentuates the security dilemma. It forces people more so than in the other sort of system to behave aggressively for purely defensive purposes. And so this kind of thing can lead to war. And he talks a little bit about the First World War in this context. And those Jervis ideas were taken up by another, I think, very impressive international relations scholar named Stephen Van Evere, now at MIT. And Van Evere applied this theory specifically to the coming of the First World War in 1914. You know, his whole notion is it's the cult of the offensive. And there's no question that a cult of the offensive existed. You look at the kind of the attitudes that were prevalent in the military at the time. It's like, at the very start of the war, we got to go and get them. We can't stand on the defensive. We have to opt for offensive action and so on. This was pervasive in Europe before the First World War. It led to the great bloodletting in the very first months of the war because people weren't protecting themselves against enemy fire. They were so intent on, you know, charging into the enemy lines. And Van Evere says, if you want to understand how the First World War came, you have to take this cult of the offensive business into account. And he lays out a whole series of ways in which the cult of the offensive could affect things. But the most important of those is what he calls the opening and closing of windows of vulnerability, windows of opportunity. What's a window in this sense? This is the idea that, well, we're strong now, but the military balance is turning against us. And so if we wait until later to have a war, we're going to lose. But if we have a war now, we could win. So now we're enjoying a window of opportunity. Or conversely, we're weak and vulnerable now, but we're building up our power, and a few years down the line, we're going to have the upper hand. So we have a kind of window of vulnerability now. It means you got to be very careful. And so Van Evere says that in a world where the offense is dominant, these windows open and close wider than they do in a defense-dominant world. And when these windows open wide, then you have this enormous incentive for countries to act. You say, maybe we don't want a war, but if war is inevitable, we want to have it sooner rather than later because we can win now, but a few years down the road, it's going to be impossible for us. Right? And so this can tip the balance between war and peace. You know, people think of this as it's kind of almost like a preventive war. War is inevitable. We don't want it. But we have to take these military considerations into account in allowing them to shape our policy. And sure enough, when you look at the historical evidence, you could find lots of cases where these military leaders, especially, but by no means exclusively in Germany, talking along those lines, where let's have a war now because if we wait, things will be worse for us. Right? The interesting thing to note about this is that rationally, you would expect one side to be making this sort of calculation and the other side to be making the opposite calculation because if the military balance is shifting, it's shifting away from one side to the other. The side that's strong now, a week later, yes, that's the side that you would expect to think, be thinking these preventive war terms, window of opportunity terms. Right? But the other side, you would expect to say, well, the last thing we want is a war when we're weak. Well, let's put it off if it's inevitable to a time when we're strong. So you would think that those two things should cancel each other out. If they don't cancel each other out, that has to be because objective factors are not decisive. Something is going on psychologically that leads both sides to think in these kind of aggressive terms, right? The cult of the offensive was, how do they even define offensive military action? It's like offensive, it's the belief that offensive action is easy. Right? Very different from a defense-dominant world. But it can't be simultaneously easy for both sides, right? What are the armies going to do? Just go right past each other as they conduct their easy offensives into each other's territory? It can't be. So you have, you know, all these problems with the cult of the offensive sort of argument. Let's see, how am I doing, Thomas? Oh yeah, one other problem. Again, this is a conceptual problem. Is it even true that offense dominant world is necessarily less stable than a defense dominant world? You know, it's kind of natural to assume that that's the case. You know, you have a world where everyone is kind of raring to go. Viscerally, it seems like that should be more dangerous than the world where people are much more content to stay on the defense. But the historical record suggests that's an entirely different way of looking at this. If you were looking for a case of a defense-dominant relationship, it's the Anglo-Russian relationship. In the course of the 19th century, Britain is a great sea power, but the British Navy, as the expression goes, doesn't run on wheels. Russia is a great land power. Russia doesn't have much of a navy to speak of. And yet these countries, Britain and Russia, clashed repeatedly, above all on the question of the fate of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. You know, there's this war, the Crimean War, and then 1877-78, there was another big crisis and so on. Why was it that both sides could pursue relatively provocative policies vis-a-vis the other? Policies that contemplated a war in a more or less frivolous, cavalier way when you look at the evidence. It was because the downside risks were limited because the relationship was this defense-dominant relationship. Britain didn't have to worry about Russia invading the British Isles. Russia didn't have to worry about the British fleet sailing up to Moscow. Right? So each of them knew that the downside risk was limited and therefore could approach the prospect of conflict in a relatively cavalier way, in comparison with how they would have felt about it if they felt like there was a real risk of total defeat and total disaster, right? Again, you got to take those kind of considerations, logical considerations, into account when you're assessing these theories. Okay, and then that leads me to the third of these great arguments. This is the argument about interacting mobilizations. You know, the talking business, the pull of military schedules, you know, drag them forward, however she put it. This is the heart of the inadvertent war argument. This is the heart of this whole argument that this war came about because of the workings of the military system. It overwhelms statesmen and so on. There's all this business with the mobilizations and so on. This is what people point. What do we make of this argument? Well, the first point, and this is a very important point, is that there was a mobilization, a system of interacting mobilizations that was in place at the time. This was the logic of the situation established by the Schlieffen Plan. Right? Don't forget what I said before, what that logic was. The Schlieffen Plan was based on the idea that Russia mobilizes slowly, the German eastern border could be left undefended, Germany can mass her forces in the west, throw the mass of the German army against France by marching through Belgium, knock France out at the beginning of the war, because one-on-one, France versus Germany, Germany was stronger. And then pivot around and deal with Russia by the time Russia had completed her mobilization, right? Taking advantage of that window that Germany had by virtue of the fact that Russia mobilized slowly. But what's the logic of the situation established by that plan? The Germans can't sit on their hands while Russia mobilizes. The whole viability of the Schlieffen Plan is based on the idea that Germany has to act fast, you know, as soon as Russia begins to mobilize. Because if Germany sits on her hands and allows the Russian to mobilize, the Germans can't leave their eastern border undefended, can't concentrate their army in the west. They have to divide their army. Offensive military action against France becomes, you know, very problematic, whether that could succeed. And so the Germans would then have to settle for a long war of attrition that they would lose in the end. So the Germans feel like as soon as Russia mobilizes, Germany has to not just mobilize, but set the wheels in motion for an attack against France and having it out with France. Right? That's what establishes the linkage between all these mobilizations. As soon as Russia mobilizes, Germany then has to mobilize as well. If Germany mobilizes and gets ready for war against France, France is going to have to mobilize as well, so on. And for Germany, mobilization means war. The mechanism exists. No question about that. But is that the same as saying that it was a cause of the war? Yeah. Something has to set it off. If people understand what the mobilization system is, that a Russian general mobilization will inevitably lead to a German mobilization and thus to war, if that's all understood, yeah? How can you say the mobilization system is a cause of war? If the Russians make the decision to order their mobilization of their own free will, not because the political leadership was overwhelmed by military considerations thinking, we got to move lest Germany move first, you know, if they're not making that kind of calculation and they set off this whole thing for political reasons because they say it's a question for us now of either abandoning Serbia or putting our foot down. If that's why the Russians mobilized for political reasons, then you can't say that the system is a cause of the war. It's like a gun, you know. It's like suppose someone is killed with a gunshot and the defense says, well, the real cause of the murder was the whole mechanical and chemical mechanism that led from the pulling of the trigger to the release of the bullet, the explosion of the gunpowder and the bullet, and thus the great speed in which the bullet entered the body of the victim, and all the physiological mechanisms that led from the penetration of the key vital organs of the victim to the death of the victim. You know, people laugh at that. Because everyone knows in advance that the pulling of the trigger can lead to the death of the victim. If it's all known in advance, factored into those calculations in advance, okay, it can't be a cause. So for it to be a cause, one or another of these two things has to be true. Either the people who make the decision to set off the process don't know what they're doing, don't understand the consequences of it, or if they do understand the consequences of it, they're not free agents. They're overwhelmed by these pressures arising within the military sphere, forcing them to act, perhaps against their better judgment, because they're worried that the enemy is going to strike them first, and haste is of extreme importance. They know that whichever side moves first is going to have a big advantage, right? So one or the other of those things has to be true in order to substantiate this inadvertent war argument. So again, we've broken it down. Those two arguments. Is it true that they didn't understand? And which of the great powers are you going to focus on? Right. On Germany? the most militaristic of the European powers, the one where you would expect if all this military stuff was so important, you would see it in effect there. Turns out the Germans don't have a strategy of moving first. They deliberately rule out the whole idea of being the first to mobilize. Why do they do it? Because the one that mobilizes first is going to be viewed as the aggressor. And if the German government is viewed as the aggressor by their own people, they can't mobilize the resources of their whole population for the war effort. They'd alienate the British. There's still some hope that the British will stay out of the war. Right? The Germans have a conscious strategy of not being the first to mobilize, waiting for Russia to mobilize first. And in fact, it is the Russians who do mobilize first on July 30th, 1914. Right? So we have to, and that's what sets off this whole process. That's what triggers this whole dynamic of interacting mobilizations. So then you've got to zero in on that Russian decision. Are the Russians doing that because they don't understand the consequences? That they think this is going to be a deterrent to the enemy doing anything? It turns out when you look at the documents that the Russians who made this decision were fully aware of what the consequences were. They knew that basically they would be precipitating the war. Their argument was that war is inevitable in any case. Were they doing it because they thought a German mobilization was imminent? No. There's no talk of that. And as a matter of fact, as we saw, for political reasons, the Germans had decided that they weren't going to be the first to mobilize. Basically, the Russians are making their decision in large part for political reasons. War is inevitable. It's a question for us of acting or not acting. Makes a little difference on the margin whether they're the first or not the first to move, but that consideration is definitely secondary in comparison to all these political considerations. Okay? You can't make the argument about ignorance. You can't make the argument about being stampeded, being overwhelmed. Right? The decision to set off the process, therefore, has to be viewed as deliberate and taken for primarily for political reasons. Okay. So where does this leave us? See what we've done here? First we establish the structure of the argument, then we see the weakness of the rigidity argument, we see the weakness of the cult of the offensive argument, we see the weakness of the interacting mobilizations argument. There's nothing left. This whole notion that the First World War was an accidental war came about because of the forces welling up from within the military system, forces that were beyond the control of statesmen, there's no there. You know that expression, I hope none of you are from Oakland, are you? Gertrude Stein has this famous saying about Oakland. She says, when you get there's no there. Well, in this case, there's no there. There's no there, no substance to this argument. These arguments come into being because they play a political role. The people who develop these arguments, they don't have much in the way of historical culture. They can be very, very smart. People like Thomas Schelling, you know, giant in the field. But he wasn't trained in a way that led him to think through these issues by looking at the historical evidence. Okay? So very important conclusion. So as I say, this tells you something not just about the coming of the First World War. It tells you something about a particular political science theory. And also tells you something, I think, quite important about how you go about analyzing a conceptual issue in this field. Okay? So that's it. Next time we're going to be talking about America's intervention in the First World War and the whole Wilsonian program and so on.